won't name names, but I was recently at a poetry event where there were three or four people of more or less the poetry, these are males, this is something that happens among male poets more than among female poets, I think, about a generation below me, say 15 years in age. And I came into the room and they were all standing in a clump. They all turned and looked at me, and in each of their eyes was a clear look that I could easily translate, and it said, "When you die, can I have your toys?" This is something that happens when you're a certain age, I realized, you know, thinking about this. I can't remember having quite such an interest. I mean, it seemed to me when I was younger that I needed the people older than me to be around as long as possible because they knew a lot of stuff that I didn't. And I don't remember being on the other end of such a frankly Oedipal gaze. That feels to me as if something else may have changed. I mean, one of the things that's happened in that regard, it may well be that while poetry and fiction workshops cause no harm whatsoever, what harm does a bad poem or a bad story cause in the world? People who like to beat up on workshops just lament the fact that there's a club that, but they belong to that a lot of other people can get into too, I think. I think those motives are fairly transparent. But in any case, one thing that may have happened as a result of the proliferation, the distribution of the opportunity to try and be a writer to a wider number of people, which after all is a very American idea, you know, that excellence will still be very elitist, but the opportunity will be absolutely equal.
Right.
Is that one thing that may have, I mean, you know how many good books there are out there which have been finalists 9 times at different competitions, which are still not published, whose authors are not quite going ahead with the next book because they're still looking over their shoulder,
right,
worrying about the last book, etc. It may be that the population is increased and that the sense of opportunity and access is diminishing because of the numbers, and that's the reason for that Oedipal gaze. It's not that these people are less generous than I was at their age, it's that they face a different demographic situation as artists. That would be my guess, and that may be turn out to be the one serious problem with the proliferation of writing programs. It makes for a lot of unsatisfied people.
Yeah, well, it's professionalized in a way that may not ultimately be that positive.
Yeah.
But of course, one of the things we were talking about earlier is that you were suggesting that the audience for poetry might in fact have grown, and I would probably credit the writing programs.
I think to a great degree that's true. And that when people get out of the age bracket where it's appropriate to go to such places, then what do? A lot of them come to writers' conferences in the summer, and they come for the same thing, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
Instruction, if there's good instruction available, sure. But also, they come for a little dash of courage. They come to be around other people who do this and care about it and don't think it's weird. So they come to give each other courage and a certain kind of dignity that it's hard to get elsewhere in the culture. So you come to these special events where
right.
it's mm-hmm. your bottle sort of like compressed in a tank, like gas.
Mm-hmm.
The need for that is so real that people will pay $2,800 to go to Breadloaf for, you know, or whatever they
and
2 weeks of their life when they probably have 3 weeks vacation,
right.
And et cetera. I mean, that's a big deal to do that. People must really need what they think they can get. And what it seems to me at well-run writers' conferences, people do carry that home with them, in fact. They take away a renewed vigor and courage and so forth. If there are institutions which can be a sort of support system that way, and there are a lot more people who are supported by it, then, in fact, they're more willing to, you know, to take it seriously and to read the books and go to the readings. I think it has a real relationship to the growth of the audience.
Yeah. Well, what you're talking about was what Hugo always said, that the writing workshop was one of the last places you could go and be treated like, you know, a human being in a way that made you feel deeply human.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was Dick's great genius as a teacher.
Well, speaking about teaching, it sounds like these are things that do apply to your own teaching, because it sounds like you still delight in it in a way that a lot of teachers, writing or anything else, don't necessarily maintain into their 40s or 50s or
beyond. Yeah, I'm lucky. I still enjoy teaching a lot. My patience for almost everything else that goes on in academic life has plummeted, and I have had to work hard not to be flippantly cynical. I've spent more calories guarding against that than I used to. I notice. I hope that's not going to be a problem in the next chunk of life ahead of me. I certainly worry about it, but the actual teaching is fine. It's less likely to happen to me at this stage of my teaching career, but I mean, I think what can damage your ability to enjoy your teaching is if you're poorly used as a teacher by the people who are in charge of assigning courses and figuring out what you can do well and what other people can do well. And if you get a bad chairman who thinks it's just as easy for you to teach a fiction workshop as a poetry workshop, or that you know, because you can teach poetry writing, you can step in and teach an essay writing class if somebody's sick. I mean, There have been a couple of times in my career when I haven't enjoyed teaching more because I felt I was struggling against the grain of the assignment I had been given and was being asked to do something that I didn't really have the experience or the wherewithal to do. And at that point, you feel yourself flounder and hate it. So for better or for worse, I've become a kind of specialist and pretty much only teach what I'm good at teaching now. And while there's some dangers in that, it saves you from that other business. I mean, everybody's been given a couple courses like that somewhere along, and it's very painful to slog your way through those courses knowing what a mediocre job you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the times when I've thought it would be easy to dislike life as a teacher if you're under the right, or in this case, wrong circumstances. But the stuff that can wear you down are issues of daily civility and governance in the department life. And when those things can grow too complicated, you have to work very hard to seal off the actual teaching from everything else. And as the money and morale get lower and lower in the well around the country and around the educational community, and it's going to continue for the next several years, I think we're all going to spend more time and more calories sealing off the classroom in that way from the rest of it, which is going to cause a lot of steady and low-grade discomfort. I hope I'm wrong.
No, it certainly appears that's where we're headed. Have you noticed, in terms of your teaching, you obviously still enjoy it. Have you noticed a change over the years in your student-writers' relationship to what they're doing? Have they changed?
Well, the last one first, have they changed? Yes, when I first started teaching, they were 75% male. They're now 75% female. I think a major change, the effects of which we've only begun to see the first results of, is that the makeup of the class is very different.
Mm-hmm.
It was only in the first 4 or 5 years that I taught that proportion I described was true. And, this would have been in the early 70s that things started to shift. My female students routinely outnumber male students these days, and many of my best students in recent years have been women. I think there's going to be a situation of near equality in another generation or two, in just terms of numbers of published poets and so forth. And there have been very few magazines in which the number of female writers has been 50% or higher, unless there were magazines specifically committed to achieving that goal. But more and more every year it's moving in that direction. And I think that's a major change, the consequences of which we've only begun to glimpse and think about. I think another thing is something you touched on when you spoke of a certain professionalization of writing programs. I think this is a problem, can be a problem. It's less a problem for me with the kind of students I have at City College whose average age is probably 35.
Right.
I don't have a single student who, if you said to him or her, what do you do, they would say, I'm a graduate student in writing. They all have another identity, a professional or familial identity.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very serious as writers, and the best of them are quite skillful. But I think for younger students than my group, which reflects being part of a big urban university and being part of City College, you know, which goes out of its way to be accessible to people. All our graduate courses are at night because we assume our students have jobs. At Columbia, for example, all their classes are in the daytime, which assumes that you still have a really good financial relationship with your parents, if you ask what that assumption is. NYU, which is much more expensive than City College, has an all-evening program for its graduate students. I think there are slightly more Hispanic and Afro-American writers in workshops than there used to be. This doesn't always make the terms of the debate richer. For example, the better black students I've had at City College tend to have a very different set of assumptions about their relationship to an audience and to a community and to a tradition than the white students, who have no idea who they're speaking for or to, and don't think this is a problem. And the white and the black students often clash rather affectionately. The animus is not at all racial or cultural even, but there's a real difference in understanding what it means to be a poet and what it means to speak as if you had an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the case of the white students, to speak as if you didn't know you had an audience and needed to figure out why you were speaking anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes, you know, that can be an issue which is, I wouldn't say it's divisive. I think both parties actually learn something from it, and we figure out a way to have a common vocabulary, and we go on, and people from both camps do good work, and they seem less like members of camps this semester. All the good things that should happen if the workshop is well run and the students are basically generous and honest. But at the beginning, there's a real moment where people have to stop and figure out that they're not speaking the same language, or what does this mean, and you could spend 3 or 4 of your first sessions dealing 50% with that and 50% with the poems.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very different. I haven't had since I was at Houston, where I was a visitor just briefly, a really good, well, I had Sanders Cisneros was a student of mine at Iowa briefly. So I've had a couple of good Hispanic writers, and they have a very different sense of what it's like to be a poet and what position that is in the culture. I mean, these are solvable problems.
Right.
And maybe even instructive ones. It doesn't automatically happen that when you throw more diverse types into the classroom, good things don't happen right away. There are moments of real puzzlement, including for me. I'm thinking, you know, how am I going to bring these two groups together? And sometimes the thing to do is not to bring them together. Let them just bang on each other for a little while until they figure out how to do it. I mean, everybody sort of sits up and admits to him or herself, I don't quite know how to do the next thing here. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. But anyway, I think the biggest problem they face is that they have no preparation, or what we think of as preparation. And maybe they have something that does prepare them, and we just don't recognize it because we're old fogies. But my sense is that the academic turf wars have destroyed the canon, and that there's some things that are good about that, and some things that are very bad about it. And one of them is that it's very difficult to figure out what texts everybody in your class has read. It's a very small number. You know, it used to be that what you did was you tried to wrestle a sort of liberal education out of your undergraduate institution, patching it together by the various things you were curious about, and then you went to graduate school and you did some more reading there, and about the end of graduate school you had a list of stuff you wanted to go back and read or things that you'd never gotten to, and so that there was, if you were a very active student, you know, you could figure out a way to sort of give yourself a, quote, a literary education if you're trying to become a literary person. But now no institution offers anything remotely like that. You go around and you give readings or visit campuses and you run into students who have read every word by Larry Levis, to name a poet I rather like, and have never opened the Greek anthology. They have no idea. They can't name more than 9 of Shakespeare's plays. And this is scandalous. This seems to me the biggest problem that these kids face. In fact, nobody was giving a liberal education to people who might want to become writers. I mean, that's not the job of a liberal education. It's much too specialized. But you could sort of pick and choose, and you could kind of put one together on a roll-your-own basis out of if you were an undergraduate. I think it's very hard for them to arrange to have anything remotely like that. And certainly they don't like hearing people like me tell them they're unprepared. And I don't. It's not acceptable discourse to say to people, you know, you should have had horses when no horses were available.
You know, in your selected poems, you didn't include a lot of poems from your individual collections, which I might have expected you to include. And you also emphasized a lot of sideline work, like the translations, the one-liner poems, as well as some uncollected poems. How have you hit upon the structure you employed in the selected poems, which is
a
milestone for a
writer? Well, this is partly an attempt to convert commercial considerations into an artistic opportunity. Peter Davison, my editor, wanted me to compile the new and selected. And my sense is that the new poems in a new and selected get lost and don't get read with the same curiosity or in the same richness of context as they would if they were in a book by themselves. And so I thought, what can I offer him that will relieve me of the need to bury some new poems in a new and selected, as I thought of it, maybe a little melodramatically. And then, I mean, the stuff that is sideline-ish in nature. It's stuff I'm fond of. I actually thought of the selected more as a chance to rescue stuff from being out of print than as a way of representing myself, whom I hardly know, in that way. I mean, to be asked to have a historical perspective on yourself as a writer is an impossible and perhaps a dangerous task, I thought. And it's a longish uncollected poem, and they're called The Waste Carpet, which is a poem I've always liked. It's the only one I revised. Everything else in that book is completely unrevised. My superstition is that's as it should be, that rather than gussying up your earlier work, you should just be writing new poems. But I liked that poem so much that I revised about the last quarter of it. Not heavily, but significantly. The small changes I made a lot of difference, or so it seemed. Because I'd always liked that poem and hadn't quite got it right. Other than that, I basically thought, well, this is stuff I don't want to see go into oblivion before it's time, since I've given an opportunity to rescue some of it. I mean, I think the other thing that I found myself acting on, or maybe I only realized after the fact that I had done this, was that I had a slight tendency to prefer poems that had been that I thought were underloved or under anthologized, poems that I really liked that that I seem to have liked more than others did. I thought I would give the world a second chance to fall in love with them. So I didn't treat it as a knowledgeable self-portrait of myself as a writer at all, and I just thought, well, what can I resuscitate? I mean, books go out of print so much faster now that the warehousing costs have become the major financial issue for publishers, you know, that things don't stay in print as long as they used to. It seems to me that they may need the second chance that a selected poems presents.
Did you feel as though something significant had happened in your life now that the selected was out?
Well, I think of it as one of the seven warning signs of being 50 for a poet. The other thing it offers people a chance to do, and because there are very few readers who have been with you the whole time, is it offers anybody who wants to a chance to read you chronologically for whatever narrative that implies. Mm-hmm. And becoming officially someone to whom that can be done. I'm not quite sure what it does, but as with the anecdote of the three Oedipal younger poets, it makes you aware that you're passing into a different stage in the eyes of the world. I don't think it feels particularly different to me.
Yeah.
But the poetry world is invited to look at you in a slightly different way, some of which will come normally with the passage of time, but some won't happen unless they're milestones, like a selected. And I probably only notice the crudest differences in that regard, but I'm aware that they're happening.
Talked a little bit about this book you're writing now, but are you looking ahead at all in terms of where you want your poetry to go?
I never have. It's always found the next thing to do, and I've always trusted that it will without thinking too much about it. The one thing I could possibly predict is that I think there's going to be more translation than there has been until the very recent past. I didn't really do much after the Follett book until the Marshall book, which is now just out. Mm-hmm. And I am two-thirds of the way through with a translation of Horace's satires. This is a more considerable task than the Marshall, just because of the length of those poems, which are only a couple of which are below 100 lines in length, for example. And I have accepted a commission, not a commission actually contains any money, but a commission, an invitation to translate for a new series of verse translations of the Greek tragedies, a big systematic edition which the University of Pennsylvania Press is going to use to announce its new director and new ambitions. Mm-hmm. It's the guy who used to be director at Johns Hopkins, which did a lot of stuff in translation of classics.
Right.
I'm going to do Prometheus Bound. Right. It seems to me that opportunities to do translation are arriving either on my own, by my own device, or by somebody else's, and I find that I welcome them whenever they show up, and that I like working on two things at once. My current book is titled, the answer to this may suggest why I don't have longer range plans than I do. The current book is a title stolen from a Scott Joplin rag, Strenuous Life, it's called, and in the last 3 years or so, my father died, and my wife got a cancer that was first told was fatal, and then it was re-diagnosed, and it was a very aggressive tumor. It took a year of treatment. It was a year of constant chemotherapy and radiation. At the end of that time, when the treatment was over and the first diagnostic tests, MRIs, etc., were taken, and the possibility that the tumor was entirely gone, this incredibly aggressive tumor had been repelled by an incredibly wearing and aggressive treatment. Her mother died, and she went to Rochester to do the stuff you do in the wake of a parent's death, and has stayed in Rochester ever since, in very good health, but absolutely unwilling to come back to New York, which in some way she associates with her illness. I've been under siege for 3 years in some way, which I take as an opportunity to not to treat yourself like a fort. Mm-hmm. But the concatenation of all that led me to think about writing a book such as a title like Strenuous Life suggests, mm-hmm. the degree to which life requires tremendous exertion. And to write a series of poems which are all written in the gravitational pull of that idea, it's somewhat the way that everything in a happy childhood is in the gravitational pull of its concerns, or the looser one of foreseeable futures, which comes about from writing a book in which you're think all the time about the past, and you think one day, gee, it's really difficult, in fact, to think about the future. The fact that that has to be a plural, because you don't think of only one, if A, then B, then this, etc. And so In that book, the drawstrings are less tightly pulled because of the nature of the thing you're looking at, which
right.
is only mm-hmm. barely visible. Right. But anyway, I mean, I preceded by a series of sort of crude curiosities, which then the book is an adventure in trying to refine and to map. I mean, at the present, my job is to finish Strenuous Life,
mm-hmm.
which is about unusual strenuousnesses on the one hand. But there's a poem or two that I'm going to write for it, which are about a subject I've never written about before, but which it seems to me in some way so obvious that you can't ignore it, which is that I've had for years various durable but endurable orthopedic problems. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is that for most of my adult life, I've been in unbearable but steady pain.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dull roar from this at all times. And I want to write a little bit about physiology and pain and managing pain and ignoring it and living with it and so forth. I mean, so the title has started to mm-hmm. to cull in all kinds of possibilities and to remind me of things that I might have paid more explicit attention to but didn't, because, you know, who wants to hear himself complain? You know, it's what you first think.
Right.
But on the other hand, you think, no, wait a minute, but I think about this, I have feelings about this. This is, you know, just because it's not polite to stop strangers on the street and talk to them about this doesn't mean that you shouldn't be writing about this. So what's always happened to me is that some set of fairly practical concerns and curiosities have suggested an enterprise that you try and shape into a book, kind of a sort of a somewhat focused curiosity. And I have no idea what the next one will be, but they don't stop. My assumption is that it will come along.
Mm-hmm.
I've never thought that, you know, it would be a good thing or a bad thing to write a long poem, for example, which
yeah.
might be one of the answers to the question of
yeah.
What do you foresee? I mean, I've never wanted to do it, but it doesn't mean that it wouldn't happen. But the reason for writing it would be that something would come up. There would be some, essentially, a life problem that I would think, you know, this is the best way I know how to think about this, and then I would set out to do it. And at a certain point, you would realize I can't do it in the usual space. And then it would happen, otherwise it won't. And I think I'm going to translate Horace's Epodes when I get done with the satires. And I'm sort of interested in translating Ovid's Amores. Not the Ars Amatoris, but the Amores, the slangier, more discursive, less didactic, more dramatic poems, which I think are more interesting than the Art of Love, and which have not been particularly well translated. And it's funny, some places, and Marshall has been probably had the best attention of any of those people. You know, Horace's satires, Pope translated a few of them, and a few of the epistles, and those are your benchmarks. But
right.
after that, it's been mostly classicists with in different skills as versifiers. And there's a body of that stuff that has not received any really good, serious attention. There's been good jobs by classicists who love them as poems and do the best they can, but that's not what you need, quite.
Especially, I mean, the enormous reception of Pinsky's translation of Dante made it seem as though people have been sort of dying to go back to read things
yeah.
that they think of as poetry and want that opportunity to do it.
Yeah, and I think that all that stuff should be translated every generation
yeah.
anyway. And the tendency has been for publishers to go out and hire a hip classicist to do it, and that's better than nothing.
Right.
But sure, the Pinsky translation is wonderful fun to read.
Yeah.
He did a really good job with it.
It
doesn't have that much Italian.
Yeah.
And he did a good job with it. I mean, it's an astonishing performance.
Yeah.
His Raphael translation, that Essential Horrors, but that's pretty, I think that's one of the last.
That's really the last one, and I think sometimes his tone is very close to right, and other times it seems to be very far off.
Mm.
The British translations of Horace have always made him sound like a slightly bookish English don with a faint proclivity for bum-pinching boys. and on the one hand, or an old, a kind of better Polonius at the worst. But actually, Horace's sort of continuous good sense has a lot of self-parody and complication in it, and it feels to me, Pope's translation seemed to me just right, but he only did about five of them. And maybe that's what scared away people in the interim. But anyway, there's possible work to be done in that area that it may be that I'll get to.
Sounds as though that when you're translating, you're writing as well. It's just
yeah, I'm usually writing as well. In fact, I went on a little spree. I had until about 10 days ago, I was writing extremely well and extremely fast, and I dropped the Horace completely. I haven't touched it for about 6 weeks. And then the last week or so, I've been doing nothing and quite content. Now I'm beginning to start to itch again, and I may well start by doing a Horace satire or two, and then I'll go back to the book that I'm working on now. But I often alternate, and sometimes work on both projects in the same day, mm-hmm. even.
So when you translate, do you do a literal translation first, or you consult other translations?
I consult other translations, and in the case of the Marshall, I had a stack of about 5 Marshall translations. He's been well served. Dudley Fitz did a translation that's pretty good, and Ralph Humphreys did a translation. There's one by James Mickey, the Scots poet, which I don't like quite as well as either of those, but which in a few places is very good. And then there are various other, you know, translations. The person who I think would have been perfect for Marshall at one stage of his writing life, maybe which may not have lasted long enough to do a book of 100, which is what I wound up doing, was J.B. Cunningham, who I think would have been a great translator of Marshall. But he did about 3, and they're perfect. But that was it. So I used all of those, and I have about 3 translations, none of which I'm particularly like. But they're all done by classicists who are better Latinists than I am, and so occasionally there'll be something, you know, I'll look at the Latin, I'll look at their translation and say, oh, I see why he did that. That's, you know, that's an unusual ablative construction, and he's so much of a classicist, he's trying to preserve that. But the way you actually do that in English is, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, so there's stuff to be learned from them, even if the verse is translation is sometimes not what it, mm-hmm. what I think it ought to be. There's still things, there are times when, you know, they know some of the historical, I've worked up a lot of historical background stuff, and I'm pretty good. I could go on a quiz show and do fine, but I don't know everything that somebody who studied Latin literature all his life does, and occasionally their footnotes are really helpful. The kind of stuff that you need to know that about is not, you know, it's not the mythology or identifying the various emperors and stuff, but it's, you know, that if you're being asked to acknowledge, in the Roman courts, and this was when people were still outside before they'd actually entered the courtroom, they're in the forum scuffing up the dirt and the stones, and somebody from the court comes out and says, we believe that this so-and-so is the defendant in this suit. Can you identify him? And if you can, you signify by turning your head so they can touch your earlobe. And there's a famous passage in Horace that I never figured out, in which somebody touches the earlobe. You just needed to run across somebody whose knowledge of Roman legal practice was good enough that they could tell you that was. You know, you could tell that you were missing something. There's something here that I don't know, but I had no idea what it was or where to look for it. It's stuff like that. That's the stuff where you're really glad for the experts, even though their translations may not be too zippy.
Yeah. You have plenty to do.
Well, that's fine. Stuff I've been reading since I was a boy. It's another one of those things. It's like, I thought a couple of times when I was younger, I thought, when I'm old enough, which I'm not yet, I'm going to do this. And I didn't have any specific program for what I had to do to be old enough.
Right.
But I just knew that I wasn't quite up to it yet. But I had always thought that I would do at least Marshall, and that if the Marshall went well, that I would take a deep breath and do Horace. And if I could do Horace, I can surely do the Amores, which are not as complicated as technically or intellectually. Horace is really he's as good as Virgil. He just doesn't like writing about people who aren't alive. And of course, Virgil doesn't write about anybody who isn't either a god or a fictional character.